Salem's Lot begins with an ending. The town of Jerusalem's Lot, Maine, stands empty, a ghost town in the most literal sense. Two survivors, novelist Ben Mears and young Mark Petrie, have returned to finish what they started. But what transformed this ordinary New England community into a nest of vampires? The horror unfolds as Ben returns to his childhood hometown, drawn by memories of the sinister Marston House that traumatized him as a boy. He witnessed something there, the hanging corpse of the house's former owner seemingly opening its eyes, a vision that's haunted him for decades. Now, as an adult novelist seeking inspiration for his next book, Ben discovers the long-abandoned mansion has new occupants, the mysterious antique dealers Kurt Barlow and Richard Straker. What the town doesn't yet realize is that Barlow is an ancient vampire who has selected Jerusalem's Lot with careful deliberation, recognizing in its isolation and insularity the perfect hunting ground for his particular hunger. Why would a centuries-old vampire choose this unremarkable Maine town? Because Jerusalem's Lot was already dying. The community's social fabric had frayed. Young people fleeing to cities, businesses struggling against suburban shopping centers, neighbors increasingly isolated. Television replaced gatherings, telephones reduced face-to-face interaction. This social disconnection created perfect conditions for a vampire infestation, allowing people to disappear for days without notice. The town's vulnerability stemmed from the erosion of connections that once made small communities resilient. The Marston House looms over the town as a physical embodiment of this decay, its deteriorating Victorian architecture mirroring the community's moral decline. The vampire infection spreads with terrifying efficiency through the town's remaining connections. Each victim becomes a predator, creating exponential growth that overwhelms from within. The pattern begins with Ralphie Glick's disappearance after visiting his friend Mark Petrie. Days later, his brother Danny dies mysteriously of apparent anemia. At Danny's funeral, cemetery caretaker Mike Ryerson becomes entranced when the corpse opens its eyes. The newly turned Mike appears at teacher Matt Burke's house, deathly pale and complaining of fatigue. Only Matt's crucifix saves him from attack. The vampires target family members first. Danny visits his brother. Marjorie Glick attacks her husband, exploiting emotional connections to gain entry. This perversion of familial love makes the horror deeply personal, reflecting how real contagions spread through our closest relationships. As Jerusalem's Lot succumbs to darkness, a small band forms to fight the growing evil. Matt Burke, the elderly English teacher, becomes their researcher. Dr. James Cody provides medical expertise, confirming victims show signs consistent with vampire mythology. Father Donald Callahan, the alcoholic priest struggling with faith, contributes religious knowledge. At the center stand Ben Mears and Mark Petrie, one a man haunted by trauma, the other a boy whose monster movie knowledge uniquely prepares him for real monsters. Mark's character bridges childhood and adulthood, embodying both innocence and wisdom. After losing Susan, Jimmy, Father Callahan, and Matt in increasingly horrific encounters, Ben and Mark face a final confrontation with Barlow. The master vampire has chosen Eva Miller's boarding house basement as his lair, strategically positioning himself at the town's heart. The basement becomes a deadly obstacle course, where Jimmy meets a gruesome end on upturned knives. When Ben reaches Barlow's coffin, the encounter becomes psychological. The vampire nearly turns Mark against Ben through hypnotic suggestion, exploiting the boy's grief over his parents' deaths. The staking provides the novel's visceral climax. As Ben drives the wooden stake through Barlow's chest, the vampire undergoes grotesque transformations, deteriorating from youthful appearance to ancient dust. Yet, this victory remains fundamentally incomplete. Salem's Lot brilliantly explores faith as a weapon against evil, with a crucial twist. Religious symbols repel vampires only when backed by genuine belief. This becomes clear when Father Callahan confronts Barlow. Initially, Callahan's crucifix glows with power, but when challenged to rely on faith alone, he hesitates. That moment of doubt dims the crucifix's light. "Sad to see a man's faith fail," Barlow mocks, before breaking the cross and forcing Callahan to drink vampire blood, a perversion of communion. This scene inverts traditional religious horror where faith automatically triumphs. Instead, King suggests modern Americans have become spiritually hollow, maintaining religious forms without true conviction. The novel contrasts Callahan's failed faith with Mark's simple, instinctive belief. Though not particularly religious, Mark never doubts his cross's power against vampires. When Mark reflects that adulthood is the ossification of the imaginary faculties, he articulates how children often see truth more clearly than adults, whose rationality has become a prison rather than protection. Throughout Salem's Lot, King demonstrates his unparalleled understanding of childhood fears. The novel's most terrifying scenes involve children, each crafted to strike at the heart of parental anxieties. Ralphie Glick's disappearance in the woods plays on the primal fear of losing a child to the unknown darkness. Danny Glick's ghostly appearance outside Mark's window transforms the familiar comfort of a childhood bedroom into a place of terror. The discovery of the McDougal baby, found drained of blood in its crib, represents the ultimate violation of innocence. The vampire children of the town, hunting their former school bus driver, perverts the natural order of protection between adults and children. King masterfully uses the vampire invasion as a metaphor for the loss of childhood innocence, but also suggests that maintaining some connection to childhood fears might be crucial for survival. The children who survive longest are those who trust their instincts and accept the reality of monsters, while adults who cling most strongly to rational explanations become early victims. Don't we all remember that childhood certainty that something lurked in the darkness? Perhaps that instinct wasn't imagination, but recognition of truths we later trained ourselves to ignore. The epilogue, set 1 year later, shows Ben and Mark living in Mexico, still haunted by their experiences. They've been tracking newspaper reports of strange occurrences spreading from Jerusalem's Lot disappearances, animal mutilations, and faces at windows, confirming their fears. The vampire colony survived and is expanding. In a final act of defiance, they return to start a forest fire, hoping to drive the creatures from their lairs. "Tonight, they won't be running sheep or visiting farms," Ben tells Mark. "Tonight, they'll be on the run." This conclusion offers not resolution, but continuation. The fight against evil persists without guarantee of victory. The novel's circular structure suggests this battle may never end. Evil, once established, can be temporarily driven back, but never completely eradicated. Salem's Lot remains terrifying decades later because it's not just a vampire story, but a mirror reflecting how communities that ignore their darkest corners allow evil to flourish in shadows. The transformed residence encircling the boarding house as Ben and Mark escape feels less like triumph and more like desperate survival against a darkness that will inevitably return.